A tale of two headlines, different stories, somewhat related, in this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. Practicalbioethics.org. The headlines are these: Georgia High Court strikes down assisted suicide law, and 76% of patients neglect end-of-life planning, both in American medical news in recent weeks. Joining us now to talk about these developments and trends is John Carney, President and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. Two different headlines, John, but indicative of what patients and medical professionals face and how they choose to act.
It really is. I think the issue for most Americans is this kind of, we're conflicted. We basically say we want to be able to fill out these documents and let everybody know what we want and we don't want at the end of life. And at the same time, we don't do it because we're afraid we're going to get caught in that decision about whether or not we have limited our care too much or whatever. And so I think a lot of it has to do with us trying to resolve that position of being conflicted and work with our healthcare providers to say, these are the things that I want and I don't want, and I want help along the way.
Let's talk about the ruling in Georgia on assisted suicide. That came down to more of a technicality than on the merits of assisted suicide itself.
Yeah,
not the case?
The Supreme Court ruled that the violation of free speech was really the distinction that they made in saying that the law was unconstitutional, is that it was against an advertisement about the fact that these folks, these Kevorkian-type folks, would be out there advertising that they would help you with your assisted suicide. And so the law struck down the fact that you cannot, that's a violation of free speech, that if somebody says, I'm going to advertise that I do this sort of work, you can't limit their right to be able to say those things as a matter of free speech. So that was really the reason. What should have happened is that in the state of Georgia, the legislature in 1994, I think already thought that that was against the law, so they didn't need to pass a law to do that. They just wanted to pass a law to say you couldn't advertise it. And what has happened since then is a couple of states have passed laws that saying that assisted suicide is a legal option, and therefore we need to pass a law in the state of Georgia to say we don't do assisted suicides in the state of Georgia. And that's really what the Supreme Court ruling said, was go back and change the law.
So the status as of today, as we record this podcast, is that there is assisted suicide that can be available in the state of Georgia, correct?
I'm not quite sure, because that was suggested by some other writers as well. I think what is clear is that it is not prohibited by law that you couldn't. I don't know that it's legal that you can. So I'm not saying that somebody still couldn't be prosecuted for the fact that they actually assisted in a suicide of an individual based on some other law that prohibited that action. But right now, the specific legality about whether or not assisted suicide is illegal is unclear.
Well, an organization known as Final Exit appeared to be the winner here. They appear, this is an organization that, as you look at it, they seem to be working on the edges of the law. They support suicide by using helium tanks and plastic hoods. It's kind of an unsavory, at least in some regards to some people, an unsavory organization.
It is for many people unsavory. I would characterize it more as unnecessary. I think if we did a better job in this country of caring for people who face these kinds of issues about intractable pain or the inability to really have a meaningful life at the end of life, which is really what hospice care and palliative care is all about. If we did a better job of that, I think we would find that these folks who are really at their wit's end in terms of trying to figure out how they live meaningfully and pain-free would be unnecessary. So I would hope that we would just simply double down and try to do a better job of caring for people and make those calls to folks like Final Exit simply unnecessary if we did a better job.
What about this ruling in Georgia affecting other assisted suicide laws in other states in the country? Do you see that as a factor at all?
I do. I think the one question here was, if you don't explicitly make it illegal, as you suggested earlier, is it illegal? And in this case, the law didn't go far enough. It said that the advertising of it was a violation of free speech. And so the assumption is, well, do we need to pass a law that says that it's strictly illegal? And I think there's some question about whether or not we needed to do that. I think what we would normally do is just simply say that the standard, the community standard, would be that this kind of thing just simply isn't right. And many people find it repulsive and abhorrent, and maybe it ought to be. But we need to be careful about whether or not, because we now have two states that have said that it can be legal, we need to be careful about it. I think the mechanism that is used, whether or not it's a physician aid in dying or whether or not it's a volunteer who goes out and holds your hand or provides you the mechanisms and the methods to do this, really puts it into a completely different realm, because it takes it out of that medical dialogue or that medical relationship that has a physician involved in a sense, hopefully doing some kind of control related to the experience of the patient, into kind of this more nebulous volunteer person who, and I think that probably makes it a little bit more unsavory to some about who is this person that's doing this, and do they really understand the extent of what it is that they're assisting this person to do. So it does put it on a much shakier ground.
Then we have the situation in California where a survey showed 76% of patients neglect end-of-life planning, but at the same time, 80% believe it's important to have end-of-life wishes in writing. We work within this disconnect, don't we?
We do. And I think that the importance, I think what your point is, that the underscoring the importance of having those things in writing and being clear about what you want in terms of your pain management, in terms of meaning in life and purpose and those kind of things, are all very important for you to have a discussion with somebody about. Name that person to help you and assist in getting that done, so that we don't end up going down this track of this meaningless existence that in many cases people just feel is a life not worth living. And how do we bridge that sense of I don't want to live a life that doesn't have meaning for me, and at the same time allowing those people to find meaning in life even though they are really hanging on by a thread. There's ways for us to do that. We know that in the work that we've done in palliative care and hospice care in this country.
Physicians have a role in this discussion, and this survey in California shows only 8% of patients, and maybe this is their recollection, they may have had the discussion, but 8% of patients had ever been asked about their end-of-life wishes by their physicians.
I don't think that's probably far from the truth.
Oh, really?
Many doctors simply wait for the patient to ask. They've also interviewed patients in other research where physicians were interviewed about whether or not they prompted or they initiated the discussion with their patients, and most physicians say they've never asked me about it. So it's kind of, again, back to this push-pull tug of war, is whose job is this to bring it up? And I think that the responsibility of a physician in understanding where an individual is on the course of their illness, how sick they really are, is really the best person to initiate the discussion. Because in many, many cases, patients don't know how far along advanced they are in the course of their illness, and their family members are scared to death, literally, of having this conversation with them to begin with. So the medical profession really has to take the first step here in being able to introduce the dialogue to begin the conversation.
The chances of such a discussion taking place rise with the age of the patient. In this study, especially those 65 and older initiate the discussion or want to engage in it. And I guess that's not surprising.
It isn't surprising. And in fact, in the United States right now, and 25% to 30% of people who have completed these documents is kind of the norm for adults. But when you move, it's very, very infrequent for younger people to do it. And when you hit nursing home populations, the percentages increase dramatically. Between 50 and 70% of nursing home residents have completed these documents. But when you take a look at all adults in the United States, it moves back down to that 25 to 30%. So we are doing a better job of having those conversations with folks, especially in long-term care facilities. But a lot of that has to do with the fact that if we can do things to them when they're in frail conditions that harm them by the fact that we overtreat them at the time that we do have an incident occur. So they're at greater risk of us doing something to them. And many of them suffer from cognitive impairment that allows us to be able to have a meaningful conversation with them about this. And we do need then a more formal method to be able to determine what's helpful to them and what's not, or what's in their best interest, or what they have previously stated that they want or don't want.
Other results of the California survey, not surprising as well. 67% rated making sure the family's not burdened financially by my care. 66% being comfortable and without pain. Making sure family's not burdened by tough medical decisions, another high rating. These are all just situations and indications that people are still struggling to find what the right balance is, I guess, right?
It is. It's a balance issue. But you know what's really, I guess, maybe not odd, confirming about this is these are just confirming data that we've known for 20 years. These results are identical to results that were done in the early 1990s, you know. So we're not finding out anything different. People don't want to be a burden. People don't want to live in pain. People want to die at home. People want to be surrounded by their loved ones. It's the same message. What we've got to do is come to grips with what is the, you know, the responsibility of the medical profession, on all medical providers and nurses, social workers, chaplains, everybody, in meaningfully engaging folks in these conversations when they're facing, you know, progressive disease and progressive illness, not waiting until they're on death's door to do this, but talking about it when it's not so scary or not so in your face, and really doing it much further upstream, where it's a dialogue and a conversation you can have about when the time comes, what does it look like to you, what do you want, and those kind of things, and not waiting till the very, very end.
So considering these two headlines, one about assisted suicide, the other about end-of-life care planning, they give us an indication of where we are today and how we might be able to move forward, and that's what you've been talking about.
I think so. It really is about addressing our own conflicts that we have internally and kind of getting beyond that or rising above it, and then engaging our doctors and care providers in that discussion. And I think I have a lot of hope here that I think as we look at an aging society, especially in America, and we're now heading that direction, obviously, with the baby boomers, is I think there's going to be a far greater willingness to engage in these conversations, because most of us now in the last 20 to 30 years have seen some pretty, you know, bad things happen by the fact that we've overtreated or really gone, you know, too much in one direction in trying to do things to people that really have not benefited them, and then all kind of sit around afterwards and shake our heads and say, how did we get here? So I think that willingness, that ability to say, you know, I don't want that to happen to me. So what conversations do I need to have with my doctor and with my family to make sure that that doesn't happen? I think we're headed in that direction. I really do. This is the numbers of people that have been downloading Caring Conversations, that have been talking to us about it, that are participating in the National Healthcare Decisions Day. All of those things really encourage me as we look at this and to say, we don't want to ever have to go there with, you know, the final exit people. We really need to be able to do a better job of this and figure out what the course of my life looks like if I'm faced with these kinds of decisions, and how do I want to make sure that I'm not going to be faced with those, you know, those options that are simply intolerable or unacceptable to me. What can I do in advance to make sure that that's there?
John Carney is president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.